Welcome to Coming Up for Air, the Allies in Recovery podcast, with hosts Laurie McDougall, Kayla Solomon, and Dominique Simone Levine.
Okay, ladies. So actually, Dominique, I think, came up with a great discussion for us today. And it's the discussion about what often happens when our loved ones go into treatment and there's kind of this initial shock and uneasiness. And we as family members do not understand what we hear from our loved one makes us very uneasy. And we don't know how to handle it. So, and what I mean by that is oftentimes our loved ones will go into treatment. They'll go into a residential treatment facility. It doesn't have to be residential. It could be another form of treatment, but it stands out most, I think, with residential treatment in that our loved one enters the treatment facility, they get there, and now they start calling home and they start talking about how horrible it is and how they don't want to continue on with the treatment. They want to come home because it's not what they thought it was going to be. And the question is, how do we help families work through this piece of it? Because it can be really unnerving for the family, right? Because you talk to the treatment facility, you talk to the professionals, and they tell you this, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen. Oftentimes, it's sold as being almost like this, oh, they're going to be doing this all day. There's a pool here. We're going to take them hiking. And you're like, oh, it's a lovely place, right, for them to go. This is great. They're going to get lots of one-on-one treatment, and they're going to be in groups, and they're going to be with people that are just like them. And right, like if my loved one is a professional, there'll be other professionals there. If my loved one is young, there'll be other young people that, you know, so it kind of gets sold that way. And then your loved one gets there, they agree to it. And then wait a minute, the reality hits and they start to panic. And they start calling home, and mom, dad, a spouse, grandma doesn't know how to respond to this and start second guessing if this is the right place for them to be anyway. And the family members are like, oh my gosh, what do I do? How do I handle it?
Right. So in one instance, I remember very well, affordable treatment in some areas can be found if you look at programs that have like an IOP program plus some housing, like a hybrid. The housing is private. You pay for that out of your pocket, and the IOP gets covered by insurance. And so when you're looking around for treatment, those programs tend to be okay. They're bused one place to the other. There's different levels of management and quality. So you want to be careful and you want to know what's going on there. But the main idea is that it's an affordable way to get housing and treatment in one place without trying to come up with inpatient fees and private pays and the rest of the troubles you may have. And so the housing turns out to be crap. The housing, you know, in one case, mom, there's no shower head. It's just a piece of piping coming out of the wall. Mom, I can't get cigarettes. Mom, send cigarettes. Mom, the food and mom, you know, the mattresses are on the floor and there's three of us in this little tiny room. That is not what we signed up for, mom. And by the end of a few days, you're ready to help your kid out of there. You are. You don't believe that this is going to help in any way. And so it happens. And even when people have called me before moving on it, it happens because it's not just what the kid is saying, right? What else is going on?
And also, I want people to understand this isn't even just mom and dad. It's also a spouse. And I also want people to think about this in terms of it's an attempt of the loved one with SUD to control how their recovery process is going to go and looking for that one. Oh, nope, this was promised to me and I'm not getting it. I'm out. And I don't think they're fully aware of it, but it's almost a way to sabotage themselves simply because they're afraid. There's fear involved, or there is the knowledge of what you're going to have to go through to get to the other side. So it's actually pretty common.
And I think we need to look at the fact that it happens across the spectrum of the various treatments. It's like people who walk into 12-step programs and say, you know, I remember people who said, oh, these people have a lot more problems than I do, or they don't understand, or they don't get it, to people who go into the highest end inpatient treatment programs, and they're like, there's too many elite people here, or they wake me up in the morning. And I feel like as a clinician, what's fascinating about this is people could walk into any situation and tell you what doesn't work about it. Any situation. It could be paradise, but it's not working. It's not what they expected, or they're, the people who are supposed to help them are not good. And truthfully, across the board, we don't know what they're dealing with. We don't know how good the clinicians are. And I just want to add this other level of information, which often there are people in most of these programs that are still getting high and still using. They sneak stuff in, and you know, that's a whole other issue. So we're not looking at paradise here. We're looking at getting you into something where you could pull out, can you get something out of it? I remember people years ago used to tell people who were going to meetings, if you get one gem out of the meeting, you've succeeded. If you get one phone number, if you talk to one person. And I feel like, you know how we talk about incremental progress with people who are using CRAFT and allies? It's the same kind of thing, that no matter how bad a situation is, you could get something out of it. So the encouragement is, how do you find the good? How do you find something valuable? How do you like grab onto something while you're there? No matter where you are, what kind of program it is, what stage of recovery you're in, what stage of looking at yourself, find something. There's always something to find.
When my son first went to, he went to this place down in Florida, and he had this counselor. The counselor's name was Brett. He was awesome. And I didn't understand it at the time, but Brett called us and he said, he's going to call you and he's going to try and lure you into a deep conversation. And he's going to try and tell you how horrible it is. And he didn't explain it deeply to me, but he said, what your job is as family members is to just get off the phone. he was like, you don't, anytime he's trying to pull you into a deep conversation, I want you to talk about the weather. And at the time I didn't understand it. And I was really, I mean, I was a mess and I was insecure about it, but we did it. We did exactly what he told us to do. And we were like, okay, I was going to do anything Brett told me to do, because I was like, no, we need to help him, right? We need to get him the help that he needs. And we did it. He would call, he would try and lure us in. Oh, shoot, I've got to get going. You know, we would end the call. Now I get it. Now I understand it so much better. My whole goal in that situation from then on was to send him the message that he was in the best possible place he could be in this particular moment. And later on his journey, he called me up and he said, I don't know how, you know, this Brett counselor, I don't know how I feel about him. And he was fishing. And he said to me, how do you feel about him? What do you think? And I said, I think he's a great guy. Looks like a great counselor to me. And he was like, I don't know. I said, well, it sounds like you need to take it up with him and talk to him about it. And I shut it down. And I don't think I was fully aware that that's what I was doing. But I shut it down and I basically sent the message that you're fine where you are. And we had visited this facility. I'm like, no, you're in a great place. It's here or the streets, you know, which is better? Here is definitely better than the streets, right? And so I learned from now on, that's my mantra, is to send this message that I am confident that this is where you need to be. And then if I get off the phone and I'm not really confident, I do think something's going on, well, I can go in and do some research and try and figure that piece out of it, but I'm not letting my son know. I'm going to do that off to the side, figure that piece out of it, right? But I'm sending this message of confidence that he's in the right spot. And then even if I don't think he's in the right spot, I think it's really bad, Okay, fine. I'll cry when I get off the phone and I'll deal with that myself and do the research necessary. So I often will tell families now, no, your whole goal is to send a message right now. That's where you should be. I don't care. You know, we can figure all this other crap out. To me, it makes sense that people would do that.
And we have to look at the dynamic that of what's our part. And with what you're describing, Lori, it's like our family members use us as the exit ramp so that they're on the highway, they're going somewhere, and it's like, I'm going to call you and you're going to help me get off of this thing. You're going to help me get out of here. And we really need to look at that. What's our part in helping them exit and not stay in the discomfort? And as we know, this process for all of us requires doing the uncomfortable things, all of us, whether we're the family member dealing with the loved one or the loved one dealing with their substances, it's all uncomfortable. Getting off of a substance is uncomfortable. Changing your life is uncomfortable. Changing how you operate day to day is uncomfortable. And this is actually an interesting point, because part of what you just described, Lori, is changing our role with that person. So if we've been the person that lets them leave, get off, do the comfortable thing, and we stop doing that, it is incredibly uncomfortable and it's painful, and they're going to feel like we're betraying them and how can we do this to them? But that's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to allow them to experience that program fully without the foot out the door. We have to be really clear, because even if you're in a lousy situation or lousy program, you can get something out of it if you keep your foot in the door. You know, and I'm just going to describe this thing. We have this thing where in Imago, which is the relationship therapy, where we talk about closing the exits. There are many, many things
of that. Marriage.
Yeah, it's for marriage usually, but I think of it in terms of all relationships. So that if you think about the relationship as a circle that's closed, or otherwise known as, I call it the grape, where it's juicy, it's alive, it's great, and all the juices are in the inside. But what people do is they puncture the holes with exit. Like for some people, it's substances. For some people, it's focusing on other human beings and not taking care of themselves. For some people, it's working too much or playing video games or whatever. It's the distractions that we use. It's affairs. But also, one of the interesting things on that list is the threat of suicide. And the threat of suicide and the threat of killing yourself is an exit, because if you are walking around thinking, oh, if I only have that, if I do that drug, I will feel better, then I'll get, it's a release. It actually doesn't allow you to focus on having the life that you want to have. So what we talk about is if you close the exits, then the juices stay in it and you get to focus on what you are doing. And what we're talking about in this situation is, if you are not somebody that's allowing an exit or encouraging the exit or facilitating an exit from whatever treatment this person is involved in, then they have to actually figure out how they're going to deal with it. And you're not allowing them to get the distraction of, I got to get out of here, this is terrible. They might still think those things, but you don't want to participate in it. Because then what happens is that you're not part of that issue. You're actually creating a closing so that they have to manage whatever's going on. Not that they're going to stay. They might leave the program, but you don't want to be part of that. You want that if they decide to leave, that's their decision, not yours.
Yeah, that's what I've been thinking for a while as I listen to you. You've said this in other settings. You are capable of working this out. You are capable of staying put. You are capable of leaving on your own if that's what you want to do. But I can't talk to you about this. I'm not involved. And of course you're involved. You paid for it. You know, blah, blah, blah. And you just say, I'm sorry. I don't have any other opinion. And you get away. And I love that, because it's what you're saying. It has to be, some of this craft stuff is all nuanced and incremental. And some of it is black and white. Like if your loved one is using, you want to remove yourself, remove rewards, allow natural consequences. You want to do it 100% of your effort. You don't want to sit on the fence and go, oh, maybe didn't use, maybe did. Oh, I feel like I'm being mean. What if I'm wrong? No, you want 100% coming down on it. And that's what you're saying here, Kayla and Lori. You're saying you need to act like it's 100% what you're seeing. And so it's 100% your responsibility to get out of it. But I also like the other major point that's being made here, because it's been on my mind since the beginning, which is, what if that treatment center is lousy? The answer is, you give 100% for staying in there. It's your responsibility. You're capable of doing this. I know you can do this. And you immediately hang up and start figuring out other options, right? And so what are the other options, which would be the questions I would pose the family member at this point? I would go, do you have money to go to another fancy inpatient place? Do you have the money to lose your 30-day down payment? Do you have, you know, if he wants to do it from the community at home now, has he got any links? Why don't you do it when the psychiatrist opens up in 2 to 3 months on a wait list probably, right? So all kinds of questions get raised in my mind as to what you're going to do in the back end, but you're going to be very clear and simple and forthright in the fact that it's not your problem.
The other thing to think about is, maybe it is not the best, but there's something there. There's someone there that they can draw from. So focus on that and don't give them the out so quickly. Step back. Don't give them the out. And just what you're saying, Dominique, is send the message that you think that they can do it. You know, okay, you might hate Brett, but he's not the only one you're working with there. So I happen to know there's 5 other doctors in place, and I'm sure you can find another confidant, which ultimately in the end, you know, just to kind of let everybody know, actually, I strongly believe the reason why Brett got picked out as the person he didn't like is because Brett was the one that was holding his feet to the fire. As it unfolded, it was like Brett was always the one about being rigorously honest and right and all of these things. And I'm like, oh, Brett's holding his feet to the fire and he doesn't want that. He doesn't like that. He has to face it. And this is why he has a problem with Brett. And what ended up happening is he ended up having an incredible relationship with this guy, ultimately, in the end, when he left and he went into a recovery home afterwards. He loved the guy. He loved Brett.
I just have to add to this, because thank you for saying this, Lori. You just have to realize that people, they have expectations about what they want, and nobody wants it to be hard. And so be careful about what you're hearing is, I guess, how I would say this. So often, like, if you, it's the situation where there's two people telling the story, you were there, you watched it, and you're like, oh my God, this is fascinating that somebody would tell this part of the story, or that's what they thought, or that's what they felt. That's one of the things I like about, you know, the act of listening is you're like, really? You know, not that you're ever going to do that. It's just fascinating how people interpret the story. Like Dominique just, and I just went to a conference and we met this person. And if you ask us both the story, it's two completely different stories. And so you need to know that. It's like that basically what's going on is that it's a perception issue. And when people come in and I'm doing an intake and I'm like, how much do you drink? Or they say, I don't have a problem. And I'm like, do you have a problem that's associated with your drinking? Because everybody's thinking about, I don't have a problem unless I'm walking around with a shopping cart with all my belongings in it. You know, that's the definition. And then when they get to that point, then they have a different standard of what's a problem. So what people believe influences what you're hearing about this, how uncomfortable they feel, what their expectations, like, am I going to get massages every day? Or like, you know, somebody just contacted me who's in an intensive outpatient program. And she's like, well, they don't let me talk. And what was interesting is they're trying to do DBT, which is a very structured format where you're actually having to look at the skills and you're not just coming in and doing a dump about how you feel. But that sounds like they don't let me talk. But it's not that they're not letting you talk. They're trying to get you to focus on skills. It's exactly the Brett story. If Brett is holding you accountable and you don't want to be held accountable, Brett seems like this horrible human being and he's mean and he's torturing me. But that's the program. And so be careful what you're hearing, because you could find 1,000 things that somebody can complain about, but that doesn't mean it's not the right place for them.
That's exactly it. And that's why I say, why I said in the very beginning of this, that I also think it's an attempt at controlling it. I mean, which is the whole thing about addiction in the anyway, is if I can control it this way, I can feel so much better. If I can get you to do this, I will feel much better. If I can do that, I will. And so then you get put in a treatment facility, and now they're kind of telling you, you got to do this and you got to do that. And we're going to do right. And you're losing that control that you were so desperate to have for such a long period of time, which is interesting on top of it, because it's actually through these methods that you will gain control in other areas of your life. That it's actually the reason why you're there is because you actually have a loss of control.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? And if you keep doing it, it'll be less control, but they've been in control of their loss of control. Oh my God, that sounds horrible.
But it's true.
Yeah, right. To a point, it works. And then depending on your socioeconomic status, on the color of your skin, on all kinds of differences, right? You're able to control and maintain your functionality. I always saw, like, when I went to university, I could pick out folks that I thought, interesting the way he drinks. But professors and people up there are protected. You know, they earn well, they can cover it well. They've got people, underlings, doing stuff that covers for them. And I always saw how the richer are able to act more functionally longer, at least with alcohol, and how that didn't do them any favors, probably. Hit more jackpots when we're poor and, you know, just a student or whatever, just trying to get along, because it's like one step away from homelessness. It's one step away from consequences, you know, all the time.
I think that's a great point. And I think it isn't just alcohol. If you look at celebrities in general, I mean, we just lost Matthew Perry, and he spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on his recovery and then trying to help other people, right? He spent all this money and he was able to maintain it for a very long period. And I bet because he had that money, people often cushion it and help him get through it and maintain his use versus allowing for natural consequences and letting the chips fall where they may, where he's more likely to then reach out for help, that kind of thing. Yeah, that's a fascinating way of thinking about it. And yeah, so maybe what family members need to do, because I know how nerve-wracking it is when you get those phone calls when someone's in a residential treatment and they're telling you all the awful things that are going on there, and you just become so unstable yourself and so worried and so full of anxiety, which we're very comfortable with anyway. And that kind of goes away when they go off into treatment, so we can replace it with a different kind of anxiety. So my point is that if you can restructure that story and your own perceptions of what's happening here, it might help a little bit, right? Like maybe actually your loved one going through a difficult time in the facility that they're in and learning to cope with that is actually just another learning opportunity, and that things are not going to be perfect no matter where they go. And so encouraging them and sending this message of, I am confident that you are in the right place right now, is only going to be beneficial to everybody.
Yeah, and this question came up because we recently got a question posed to us about an elderly gentleman going into an inpatient program, and I guess immigrant, so I guess he had been told there would be others like him, and there were four young men and him. And at that point, he was ready to exit. And so that our viewers, our listeners know, there is no way to keep anybody in treatment unless it's a lockdown situation. Those don't exist unless you civilly commit somebody or a 72-hour hold in a psychiatric unit. So the reason we're going through all these machinations is because it's up to your loved one to stay there in the end, right? They can walk right out that door. And that's what this elderly man was ready to do. He said, I thought there'd be people like me. There is no one like me. And I'm ready to go. And so the wife, also elderly, I assume, is having, you know, to like over the weekend, Thanksgiving weekend, you know, it always happens on a Friday night. So I reached her and she said, he's staying put. And I said, okay, so urgency off, but I still have other questions. And because we write these very tailored answers to questions that you pose us on our site. I need a few answers about sort of what I was getting at. What's the alternative? Is there an alternative? Is it really horrible? Is it still really horrible? And is he basically walking, right? Is he walking? And what's the alternative? And I thought, you know, over the weekend, I thought, wow, he could learn a lot from 28-year-old white kids from suburbia or this Southie from Boston who's, you know, finally got a scholarship bed in that place. And it's your perspective. And I bet by the end of it, this will have been an amazing experience. And how can it not be? It's so intercultural. And I understand cultural competency and the need for being with people that are like you and look like you and, you know, have experiences like you. I understand all of that. But this was a real opportunity, if he stays put, to have a really different introduction. And I think this is only the second time he's ever had any abstinence at all.
There is one thing that they have in common.
Yeah.
A kind of big one, yeah.
Substances.
But also, that I have heard that so many times. I'm 20 years old. Everybody's old here. There's no tailored program where it's going to be like, okay, I'm going into treatment and there's going to be this person who's exactly me in the treatment and there's 40 me's in the treatment. It doesn't work that way. You have one thing in common, which is the reason that you're there in the first place, which is what substance are you dealing with maybe, or that you're dealing with substances at all, or mental health issues, or both. That's it. And it's like, yes, yeah, somebody's going to be depressed and somebody's going to be anxious and somebody's going to be hearing voices, but you're all there to be working on the same thing, which is to get better and to heal. And if you could just have that as a perspective, that would be helpful.
I hear you, and I agree for the most part, but I do think that there should be offerings for like youth and young adults versus 40 and 50 year olds. But that's in an ideal world because there isn't much out there.
Yes, that's the problem.
There isn't much out there, but yeah, I absolutely do think that it should be separated. But I also think that it's really difficult to do. And I really wonder, because I know the case that Dominique is talking about, I really wonder how different this, maybe much older than the group, but I doubt that they're youth and young adults. I have a feeling that they're like 30s and they're getting closer to that age. And I actually feel the same way that it's, again, send that message. No, you're in the, yeah, there may be an age gap between you or whatever, but what can you get from this, right? And focus on that. So we are really coming to the end of this recording. So Kayla, we need you to sum it up for us.
Okay, so our loved ones go into treatment, whether it's outpatient, inpatient, 12-step, other meetings, whatever, and you wind up getting a call or hearing the message that it's not good enough, that there's something wrong, that they don't fit, this is not what they signed up for. And so what we're saying is regulate your own emotion, realize that there's discomfort involved and they're trying to get you to get them out of there, and hold the line, please, just at least temporarily, hold the line and let them have their discomfort, engage as much as they can. You're not going to start doing the talk of getting them out of there, because it's like basically you're hatching a plan to get them out. Let them stay, let them be uncomfortable, and give them the message that they can manage it and you're hoping that they get something out of it and that it would be great if they try to find something good about it and not just focus on the bad. But you're basically not allowing, you're not part of their conversation about leaving. That's the bottom line. And then most places you'll be able to leave on your own, but you don't want to be part of that plan.
Thanks for listening. We hope this episode of Coming Up for Air spoke to you. If you're listening in today on a podcast platform that isn't the Allies member site, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating. This helps others find the show more easily. If you have a suggestion for a new topic or a guest for the show, please reach out through the Contact Us form on alliesinrecovery.net. Special thanks to our hosts, our guests, and our production team.